be taken under advisement. The last case this morning is number 02-2892, the United States against Eugene Haywood. Mr. McGowan.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Andrew McGowan. I'm with the Federal Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois, and I represent the appellant, Eugene Haywood, in this case. Mr. Haywood has raised two issues in this appeal, and I'll try to get to both of them. The first one is the district court's finding that he didn't have an objective expectation to object to the officer's search of the car that he had been driving. The second one was he appealed the jury conviction for conspiracy to possess more than 50 grams with intent to deliver based on there being insufficient evidence introduced at trial to support convictions. The first issue, the reasonableness of the search, he was not able to object to it because the district court found that he didn't have an objective expectation of privacy. As this court knows, there's a twofold process by which the court evaluates whether somebody has what used to be called standing. And in this case, the court found that he had a subjective expectation of privacy because he's been driving the car with the permission of the person who'd rent the car, but it was not an expectation of privacy that society was willing to protect.
Why should society be willing to protect the interest in driving a car of somebody with a revoked license that the rental car company would never have permitted as an additional driver, as the sole driver, as anything else? I mean, it's like giving the car to your 12-year-old daughter and saying, drive it down the street. Well, you could do that, and she might think she was able to. Maybe she wouldn't even have a wreck, but it doesn't seem like society ought to be prepared to recognize that interest.
I understand the court's concern. I would differentiate this case between a 12-year-old. Mr. Haywood is definitely able to drive, and she had been living with him for a couple of months and certainly was able to observe that.
But if the state has decided that he doesn't have that privilege for whatever reason, you know, maybe he drove drunk or maybe he has a medical condition, we don't know. I mean, it's just, we know the state doesn't let him do it.
I think that's the problem in this case, and I think that's why the Supreme Court has sort of indicated that personal privacy or property rights shouldn't really rule in these
But why is that? I mean, I guess I'm willing to take the state's word for it. I mean, driver's licenses are a privilege, and if it's revoked, you don't have an objectively reasonable interest in being the driver of a car.
Your Honor, I certainly agree to some extent with that statement, and I think that there are remedies. Obviously, for instance, Mr. Haywood was arrested because he didn't have a driver's license. The state can do other things to him as a violation of that requirement. However, I don't believe that that's necessarily the be-all and end-all in this case, and I think it would certainly be ironic if the very reason that the officers were able to arrest him prevented him from being able to object to the way they searched him, which is what the result would be in this case. He had never driver's license, so of course he could be arrested, but he wasn't able to object to the search simply because he didn't have a driver's license. And the cases that we have before the court, the split and circuits, Best, for instance, is the case that we're relying on primarily, features somebody without a driver's license.
And in fact, stole the car.
Was it a stolen car?
No. What if you steal a car?
I don't believe that under the... I wouldn't be arguing if he stole the car, that he had a legitimate expectation of privacy there. I wouldn't be here arguing. I don't think that would be something that the Supreme Court would authorize or any courts have authorized. And in fact, the example of the Supreme Court had to do with a burglar in a house. You know, the person was there. He had a subjective expectation of privacy, but not a legal one. However, I think that this is substantially different because people can drive cars without licenses. It's not quite the same thing as burglary. And furthermore, I think this goes into the ability of the person who rented the car to give the person permission, too. I think they're similar, and I also think that shouldn't prohibit this court from finding there's an objective expectation of privacy, first of all, because not everybody who rents a car can take the person that may be using the car in the future to the rental car company. Cars are rented to go out of state. They're rented to visit other people in different towns. It's just practically impossible. Furthermore, those provisions in those contracts tend to be to protect the insurance company or to protect the renter company.
But you know, let me suggest a slightly different variation of an unauthorized driver. If he had been driving along with his girlfriend and she had suddenly felt extremely ill, and they had pulled over to the side of the road, and he then took the wheel just to get them to a place where she could receive treatment. What it reminds me of is the kind of more nuanced approach that the Sixth Circuit was looking at, saying, you know, we're going to have this sort of general presumption that if you're not an authorized driver, you don't have standing, but there might be really extraordinary circumstances, and I don't see those kinds of extraordinary circumstances here.
Well, in the Sixth Circuit's opinion, they rely on these extraordinary circumstances, but rely primarily on the relationship between the person who drove the car and the rental company. I mean, they say it's the most important thing, and in that case, I think he'd used his credit card. He's the one who contacted the rental company to rent the car. Those factors are certainly not in this case, but I don't think that should be the all and end all of that evaluation. I really do think that you're going to have a situation, just as Your Honor proposed, this happens all the time, where somebody who doesn't have the ability to drive the car under the contract has to, for some emergency or other reason.
Sure.
And usually at the for the benefit of the person who rented the car in the first place. Maybe there's a child who needs to be go to the hospital or whatever. And
but that's not our case, though.
No, it isn't.
That's the thing.
But the Sixth Circuit ruling, its evaluation, really, I don't think takes into account that possibility. It's something that happens all the time. And for those reasons, I don't believe that the Circuit's opinion is as the good reasoning behind it that the district court in this case is credited with. And I believe that the best case in the Eighth Circuit is more appropriate because it does not rely so much on actual property rights. If there are no more questions about that issue, I would go on to the next one. Mr. Haywood was charged with a conspiracy to possess more than 50 grams with the intent to distribute. The only agreement that was introduced at trial was between Mr. Jackson and Mr. Haywood to go up to Chicago to buy drugs and then bring it back down. Mr. Jackson testified at trial. He had the opportunity to talk about any kind of knowledge that he had about Mr. Haywood's client, any kind of other information about what was going on to establish conspiracy. There was no evidence introduced at trial about that. It was simply a random, every so often, they'd be talking about going up to Chicago to get some drugs, and they went up to Chicago and got some drugs. And we don't think that under the law of conspiracy as it is developed in this circuit, and particularly as it most recently has been articulated in Thomas, leaves a legal basis for the government's conviction to stand in this case for conspiracy. For those reasons, Your Honor, we would ask that the court remand with instructions for the requested relief that we've asked for, and I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. McGowan. We'll hear now from Mr. Chambers. May it please the court, Mr. McGowan. Judge Mem was correct when he ruled that an unauthorized driver of a rental car does not have standing to object to the search of that car. There is no societal interest that we can find in this record to allow somebody who's driving that car in clear violation of the contract between the renter and the owner of the car. Especially in this case where the defendant did not even have a driver's license. He couldn't have been an authorized renter of that car if he had wanted to. If he'd shown up out of the Peoria Airport at Enterprise Rent-A-Car and said, put my name down on the rental contract also, they would have said, let me see your license. He wouldn't have been able to produce a license. He couldn't have driven that car.
But, you know, Mr. Chambers, it seems to me what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. When we are looking at cases, for instance, all of these curtilage cases, where the question is whether a search took place appropriately or not and whether the owner of the home had an expectation of privacy, the government is quick to say legal technicalities, such as the fact that you own that property, are not enough to answer the Fourth Amendment question, that there has to be some additional indicium of privacy. And I would say the same thing logically ought to apply here. Yes, the contract and the rights under the contract are an important factor, surely they are, but there are many, many circumstances where people you know, let somebody else drive a car they've rented, and they don't pay the extra $10 to get an extra driver on the car. And I'm not sure that's enough in and of itself to resolve the case. Now, as you point out, we have more here. We have the fact that under no circumstances could this man have been a driver. But I'm troubled with just this rigid, you're not in the contract, ergo no expectation of privacy argument.
Your Honor, I think that's what the court in U.S. against Smith was looking at.
Well, they had a bunch of other factors, though, and of course you know the circuits are all over the place on this issue.
Well, it appears, though, that except for the circuit where Best comes out of, Smith, generally speaking, they look at the contract. I know that circuit focuses on the permission given by the renter to the unauthorized driver, and we would submit she simply didn't have the authority to give that permission. Smith says, though, the standard rule is an unauthorized driver doesn't have authority, doesn't have standing to contest the search. But there could be special circumstances. One, maybe what the court mentioned earlier, if there was a sick child in the back of the car, or the driver became ill and she turned to the unauthorized driver and said, get me to the hospital, and they were stopped on the way. Smith said that, too. And in Smith, it was even, in Smith, Mr. Smith had a driver's license. He could have been an authorized driver. But even more important than that, he's the one that rented the car. He called, he used his name, he used his credit card, he took the confirmation. He was, as the court in Smith said, the de facto renter of the car. So I think there are circumstances where the rule could be mitigated.
Well, what if you had a chauffeur? You're the renter of the car, but you're not the driver. You go with your chauffeur to the rental agency and you say, Jones here is going to be the driver, and so Jones shows his driver's license. Surely the person who rented the car has a reasonable expectation of privacy in it, even though he's not the driver.
That's true, because they have the business relationship, and under the contract, they're renting the car.
Right. So in other words, there's nothing magic about being the driver. Maybe sometimes being the driver shows you do have an expectation of privacy, but it's neither necessary nor sufficient. So why doesn't Mr. Haywood have an expectation of privacy, since he was, in fact, the only person in the car?
He was. He was the only person in the car, but outside of the contract, he could have never been that authorized driver. He didn't have a driver's license.
Neither can my person who has a chauffeur. We'll assume he's blind or something.
But I think then, though, we would fall back on the Smith case and say that if you and I went down to the rental agency and I said that you were going to drive for me because I had some disability that didn't allow me to drive,
mm-hmm.
the rental agency knows what the situation is. It,
mm-hmm.
Maybe it's not explicit in the contract, but it certainly, as in Smith, was implicit. We are both the de facto renters of that automobile. Here in this situation, that simply wasn't what happened. She went out and rented the car, and apparently she had done it before for other drug trips. She went out and rented the car, gave it to him. He, without a driver's license, got stopped. The issue of the sufficiency of the evidence, on the morning before oral closing arguments, Judge Mim gave us the jury instruction that we worked under. We've never seen that jury instruction before. Can't find any support for it in the case law. However, knowing that Judge Mim is a very careful judge, and I spent a lot of time thinking about this, we believe that instruction, we're not arguing against the instruction, we're not arguing that the court ruled the instruction was bad. We argued to the jury under that instruction. We accept the burden here today to proceed under that instruction as an accurate statement of the law. I could, in thinking about it, think of a situation where that instruction may come into play. If there were two drug addicts down on the corner and they each had $20 and they said, let's pool our money and go and buy a couple rocks of crack cocaine, and they went down to the local drug house and bought a couple rocks, and then they split up the rocks and sold half of it, and they did that once or twice, I guess you could apply that instruction. So we're not standing here in front of the court saying, find that Judge Mim didn't have or made an erroneous instruction to the jury. What we're standing here and saying is, take that instruction. We proved the case.
Well, if anything, that instruction was favorable to the defendant. Is there a way that that instruction favored the government?
No. We objected to it.
Right. And so, since you won, even with that instruction, we don't really have to worry too much about it unless there's something else that makes this merely a kind of buyer-seller type case.
Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor, that's exactly correct. And with those arguments, I will rest and ask the court to affirm the district court's.
Thank you, Mr. Chambers. You have 2 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Just briefly, I would like to address the prosecution's assertion that she had rented the car, Yatisha Sturtevant had rented the car for other drug trips. I believe that the evidence showed, first of all, that the trip in question, she rented the car to be able to go to work back and forth. I think the evidence does show that there were some trips with a rental car, and it would have been she that rented it, but there was no evidence that she knew that that's what the car was being used for. I would also like to address, again, the standing issue. There is one factor that I think is important to the court to take into account, and that's simply that there's no evidence in the record that Mr. Haywood knew the terms of this contract. In fact, the contract's in the record, it's a couple pages long, and it is really fine print. Now, does that mean that he should be benefited by this? I just think that it's another factor for this court to consider when you're considering the effect of ruling that it matters what the contract is. This person has a personal right against unreasonable searches and seizures, and if he doesn't know something that could prevent him from being able to object to a search, that should weigh in against this court saying that that's a very significant factor, as the other circuits have found. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. That concludes this morning's call, and the court will therefore rise until 9:30 tomorrow.